The BioRevolution Podcast.
Your hosts,
Luise von Stechow
and Andreas Horchler. Welcome to the BioRevolution Podcast. It's kind of funny. When I was a little boy, it was a heyday of LSD, praised for an alleged mind expansion capacity. Obviously, there was a story about psychedelic substances reaching much, much further into the past in labs, but also in religious ceremonies. The wish to alter what's going on in our brains is kind of ancient. So today in the BioRevolution Podcast, the biochemistry of the mystical. I like this. I love this title, Easy. A psychedelics renaissance. Welcome, Easy.
Hello, and I'm very excited to finally talk about this topic because I have been thinking about that for years and I'm really interested. And I'm very happy to have a guest today, my friend Galina, who is a former colleague and who knows more on the topic than anyone else I know. So I will be very happy to hear her expertise on it.
You didn't only bring Galina, but you also, of course, as always, brought quotes. And I may have a wish because you brought three quotes and I would love to read the third one.
Yes. We'll actually, I would say we each read one because Galina also brought one and then we'll share. I'll start with Albert Hoffman and I guess you want to read Abby Hoffman. And Galina will contribute one from Ramdas, which is also nice. So we're actually moving quite to the past for all our quotes and see, I would say, very different angles of the psychedelic situation also, which I think is very nice. I'll start, I think, with the first quote from Albert Hoffman, who is, of course, famously the discoverer of LSD, who said, "When you study natural science and the miracles of creation, if you don't turn into a mystic, you are not a natural scientist," which I very much like. And I might hand over to Galina for the Ramdas quote, maybe.
Mm-hmm. So my favorite Ramdas quote is, "If I'm going to die, the best way to prepare is to quiet my mind and open my heart. If I'm going to live, the best way to prepare is to quiet my mind and open my heart." And Ramdas, his original name is Richard Alpert, and he was a Harvard researcher together with Timothy Leary in the 60s. And both of them were experimenting with LSD, both for their work and then also privately. And as we know from history, their lives turned very different directions, with Ramdas becoming a spiritual leader and Timothy Leary being arrested a number of times and wanting to put LSD in water for everybody.
Yeah, fascinating. And the third quote is, as Easy mentioned, from Abby Hoffman, and it's kind of reminiscing. "The 60s are gone," Hoffman says. "Dope will never be as cheap, sex never as free, and the rock and roll never as great."
Maybe we have an introduction of Galina and her expertise. Galina is a neuroscientist by training. Actually, she studied the neuroscience in Cross. Is that correct, right? And which I find very fascinating, I have to say. And then moved on into strategy consulting and then moved on into actually the companies who are working with bringing psychedelics to patients for different mental illnesses. And maybe, Galina, you can say a few words about your journey.
Yeah. My journey was always driven by curiosity. So I actually started in studying gut and ulcerative colitis. And already there, dopamine neurons played a key role. And I was living in Ukraine at that time. And I thought if brain has such, or nervous system has such a huge effect already in gut, why don't I study nervous system? And there was no systems neuroscience in Ukraine at that time. That's what brought me to Germany in 2011. I moved to Tübingen, where I did my master's in cognitive neuroscience. And then I moved to Switzerland for a PhD. And there I worked on neuroprosthetics. And we already used AI before it became that sexy. What was it, 13 years ago? And afterwards, I worked in strategy consulting. That's where Easy and I met. And I went on working as a director of strategy for a psychedelic company, doing medical route of psychedelics for mental health. And currently, I am doing initiatives for Ukraine to help with the mental health crisis there, and specifically focused on the Ukrainian-Western collaboration around psychedelics for mental health.
Well, what a fascinating journey indeed it is. I'm really curious how this came into life, that the drugs came back into sight after having vanished for decades, but we'll get to that point. But for starters, I guess we have to begin with the brain, which is a strange, a complex organ, hard to comprehend. Even for neurosurgeons, I think they claim to know a bit about the brain, but not more than that. So how much sense are we capable to make by now when it comes to studying this organ?
Yeah, I think this is really the question, and also the question why I find psychedelics so exciting. So I actually also set out to study biology because I wanted to study the brain. I was not like a biology person, or not so much of a natural science person in high school. You know that, of course, that I was like a history nerd, literature nerd. But then I got really interested in how the brain processes language. And then I actually started studying biology to find that out, because I was diving deeper and deeper, reading Chomsky, reading Pinker, and then really wanted to know more about this. And I think for me, I have the feeling I was too cowardly to go through with it, because for what I learned during my studies about the brain, I had the feeling it's not going deep enough. You can either go to this very molecular level and understand like single molecules and what they do, or you get to this very high level of just doing imaging studies, which also tell you, okay, this region lights up, but it was for me somehow not enough. So I really wanted to get to this picture of seeing it all. And I had the feeling, at least at the time when I was studying biology 20 years ago, I was nowhere close to understanding that. And when I learned more about psychedelics, which I have to say I found in the beginning, like when I first heard about it, and it was a study of LSD and MDMA for, I think, PTSD, and I thought like, this is such a strange idea. Why would you do that? And then I started reading up on it, and I got just very fascinated with the topic. And what I find really interesting is that with this tool of mind altering that psychedelics are, you actually have a better chance to understand how the brain works fundamentally, or how the mind works. And this is what I find, I think, which leads me back to this journey, why I even wanted to study biology and why I wanted to understand basically humanity, I have to say. I think this was at the quest of what I was doing. And therefore, I find this idea of psychedelics super interesting as a tool to understand that better. And I'll hand over to Galina.
Yeah, this is fascinating. Actually, I had a very similar rationale, and that's how I got into neurophysiology. So my fascination was also this systemic, how do we find neural correlates of behaviors? And that's what I studied in crows, in rats, and we were looking at different from single neural levels to more systemic multineural recordings to find, as the change in behavior happens, what happens in the brain. But actually, after being very much into this whole psychedelic field, I see it, the system is beyond the brain. It's no longer just the brain for me. It's also leveraging the whole intelligence. It's also somatic intelligence from the body. It's also emotions, which are metaphysical. We can't measure them. They are this experience that happens to us, which is not physically measurable. We can only find correlates. And that's why what I didn't mention in my intro, I'm also now into holistic coaching and into creating experiences for people, not using psychedelics, but using different techniques to also help them shift their consciousness and their way of relating to reality.
How do you make a distinction between the, and we get into the history, I think, a little bit, between mushrooms and LSD? So between the natural side of things and the lab side of things.
Yeah, I think I'll start quickly and then hand over to Galina, who knows much, much more than I. There are a lot of different types of psychedelics, which have, I think, a common mechanism about the receptor that they engage and therefore have some common effects. But the intensity of the effect and the duration of the effect differ very much. But in the end, I would say, and Galina, you can correct me if I'm wrong, it's a little bit that basically what Hoffman created in the lab or extracted from the ergot mushroom in the lab was simply a very condensed version of something that we also find in other types of psychedelics, which again have, I think, based on other properties, other substances that they contain, slightly different functionalities than LSD would have or psilocybin, which is the active component of what we would call magic mushrooms is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I agree that the common or classic psychedelics, the common mechanism of action is called serotonin receptor 2A, 5-HT2A receptor. But there are two key distinctions between LSD and the mushrooms and ayahuasca, DMT. One is the what are the other receptors that this molecule also hits, which is not a primary target. That's one. And the other thing is what are the substances that are ingested together with this molecule. So it's very different if you ingest a clean LSD, let's say, and a clean psilocybin, which is the component in mushrooms, versus you take the full mushroom. It will have different chemical composition, and it will also create different effect. And all of that, even like on a higher level, depends on also the context in which you are taking it, which is the famously quoted set and setting by Leary. And this is really, it's a huge difference whether you take, let's say, mushrooms on a party versus you do a high dose in a medical setting, highly controlled environment, and with a different intention.
Yeah.
Which I have to say on a personal note is why I don't dare to take psychedelics, because I would be very afraid, or I once did it when I was young, but I'm very afraid to do it in a non-medical setting. So I once signed up for a clinical study as a healthy volunteer. They didn't take me because I would like to have, and it was in Switzerland, so I would like to have a very, how you say, like nice looking Swiss doctor in a lab coat in a very clean room with the view out of nature with me when I'm doing it, because I think for me that would be the setting that would be the right for me, where I would feel like this is going to go well and not going in the wrong direction.
And this is very smart of you, because while, you know, we care about efficacy, my main concern is always safety with the medicines. And as you already mentioned, that MDMA is also being studied for PTSD, but also other psychedelics. And what can happen is that the trauma can resurface and it can come back to memories. And one thing, you're doing it with a doctor who is trained to help a traumatized person. And another thing, it happens at a party when everybody's high and nobody cares. And there are actually instances of re-traumatization that are reported, because when it comes up in a party, nobody is helping you and you are in this highly receptive state, it's actually a very, very challenging experience.
Okay, I just mentioned that back in the day, we didn't give a full stop. You know what I mean. So I'm not getting further into that. I would be very interested in the Hoffman story, where everything started with a magical bike ride, right?
Yeah, it was a bit funny because I wrote like a small script and I said, what was the dose that he took? 250 micrograms of LSD, which he ingested to test it on himself. And I wrote quite decent. And Galina wrote a comment, 125 micrograms is already a full trip. So the dose was double decent.
Good expression. Yes. I like it.
Yeah. And then he went on a bike ride.
On the bike ride. Yeah.
And the psychedelic community celebrates it. It's 19th of April as an International Bicycle Day.
Yeah. So to dig deeper in history, that occurred in, my understanding, is the 1930s, didn't it?
Exactly. He synthesized it first in 38 and then the bike ride was in 43.
All right. So this story basically starts in the 1940s and is respected by doctors all over the world. There are treatment ideas that are popping up, experiences that are not so bad. Then the hippie culture comes up and, you know, it becomes a party drug, as Galina would say, probably. Then it's banned and then it vanishes for decades, which is an obscure kind of story because you did have evidence before that it's doing something beneficial, right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that there is like a mountain of evidence. A lot is anecdotal, but still there is a lot of evidence that psychedelics could be helpful in a psychiatric setting for conditions like depression, substance abuse, anxiety. And there you had a lot of psychiatrists experimenting with it. And I think the bad reputation that it got was really from being this part of the counterculture. I mean, what we had in the beginning, that we had like Abby Hoffman, that we had Timothy Leary, who had this like ideas. I mean, they propagated, I think, in a way that was speaking to some people, but didn't really speak to Richard Nixon and other people. And
I think
USA was very leading in banning these substances over time. I think LSD was amongst the first and then others followed. And I think this really just gave this a little bit wrong image of these substances. Not that I'm saying that there is no danger in taking these substances, obviously, if you take them in the wrong setting, but I think that they were put in a similar bucket as drugs that have a very different effect in the sense that they are very addictive, which are, for example, opioids.
Right.
And I think something similar, again, happened to MDMA, which is not a classical psychedelic. We can talk about that in a second, what it does. But again, I think this was also banned also after some not really conclusive evidence was put out about that it has, for example, destroys brain cells on large scale, which I think was just a study that didn't really hold. And again, here, I think it's just this association of being a party drug, of being a part of like a maybe youth movement, which was somehow not well received. Let's put it like that. Galina, what do you think?
Yeah, exactly. So what happens, they were moved to the Schedule 1 substances. And Schedule 1 is the substances that are dangerous and without known clinical benefit. And of course, there is no clinical benefit if you don't let people study it. Because already in the 40s, there was many psychiatrists studying them and there were promising evidence. And also not even MDMA, but MDA, another derivative of it, was used for couples therapy because it enhances this empathy and openness towards opposing opinion. And of course, it's difficult. Nobody's reimbursing couples therapy, but I think if they were, we would have less conflict in the world.
Yeah, overall. And believe what the economic outcome would be of that if there weren't any, you know, uncoupling tendencies anymore. I mean, that's a good thing, right? So they should reimburse it. What do we know after like 70 years of LSD and the other substances included? What do we know about what is actually happening in our brains when we take it?
So starting with cellular level, I would say there are different mechanisms from psychedelic. So there is a 5-HT2A receptor activation in the classic psychedelic. MDMA works by basically blocking the reuptake of serotonin. So you can imagine it as one neuron sends serotonin to communicate with the other one and takes it back. And so you prevent this taking back. And so the natural serotonin stays longer in the synapse. And because of that, you can think of MDMA depletes your own serotonin, while the other classic psychedelics, they bring in a new serotonin in the system, serotonin-like molecules. And actually, if you look at psilocybin formula and serotonin, they look very similar. It's like the plant serotonin.
And I mean, serotonin is something that makes you feel happy. Oh, yeah. One could say is something that makes you feel happy and therefore would release good feelings.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And it leads to this good feelings, but it's not addictive because it doesn't hit the dopamine and the reward system. So it's like this feeling of oneness, of love, it is also called oceanic boundlessness. So like being dissolved in the ocean, that's the highest state of ego dissolution that is also recorded in clinical trials. And it's interesting that in clinical trials, we look at both what it does to the traditional depression scores, anxiety scores, all of that. But also there is an experience, clinical experience questionnaire where people actually report how connected they felt, how oceanic boundlessness. Oh my God, oceanic boundlessness is
that's
one
a
of
beautiful
the
word.
Yeah. And I think one of the interesting parts is that it seems, at least from the studies that I read, that this ego dissolution or the oceanic boundlessness is actually what is connected to this strong effect that these substances show for people with depression or substance abuse or similar things. So it's not only taking the substance and uncoupling it from this feeling, but it seems to be strongly related to that feeling, which then I think leads some researchers to speculate that something about taking basically, yeah, cutting somewhere within this ego that constantly judges and ruminates and has all these negative emotions that can run in circles can be actually something that can be curative or can be curative is always a strong word in pharma, but can be at least to an extent really better the condition. And this is what I find the most fascinating, I have to say, about it. It has been likened to just unplugging basically a machine and replugging it. And we all know that this is long tried cure for any IT problems, that you would just take out the plug of the printer and put it back in and miraculously it works again. And maybe this is something akin to that that is happening actually in our minds or brains.
Just going through my head, I could think of some formidable patients for, you know, unplugging. I'm not getting into that now, but anyways.
Actually, yes, I think we should get into that because that's what people think. So I do like this theory about how this reset to the system can change the patterns. So there is this, the disorders that are targeted with psychedelics are so-called ruminating disorders. And rumination is this loop. You can really imagine there's the same loop that's playing in your head about some negative thought that you are stuck in. And then you come in and you reset the system and you basically see the same problem, but maybe you see it like from the moon and you look there and from the moon, this problem doesn't look so big anymore. And maybe you start seeing new connections. Maybe it's not just this one interpretation. And it's such a huge shift, especially when the shift is about the sense of self. Because, and, you know, maybe we don't get too deep into sense of self and where it's coming from. There are really fascinating studies of split brain patients that seem to have different personalities than the stroke cases. We can link them. And also near-death experiences.
Oh, yes.
What happens when you zoom out of this strong sense of self. Yeah, but basically here you saw your problem from the moon. But then the context matters of how you integrate it. And that's why I said we should get into this ego's discussion, because you might get this new perspective, but then you may choose to bring yourself back to the same environment when you're in highly neuroplastic state and to get even deeper into your, I don't know, obsession with capital or whatever you are obsessed, power.
Yeah, or just substance abuse. I mean, this is, I think, a very classic thing, right? That you crave the next hit. And
exactly. So it's about, I think of psychedelics as something that opens this window of neuroplasticity, which has also been shown in animal studies. So they increase the plasticity of the system. But then how you modulate this system is really important to think about beforehand, to set an intention and to create an environment that will support you in that direction.
Yeah, and move it in a positive direction. And I think what you're referring to is also such an interesting part of the psychedelics potential mechanism, that it actually increases the neuroplasticity. So neuroplasticity means that brain parts or brain cells can take over functions from other areas. And we see that, for example, in stroke, we see that in other areas like
spinal cord injury.
Exactly. If you have some kind of brain damage, then other parts of your brain can take over. And this is something that is increased by psychedelics. That means, again, this idea of you're offered to an extent, I mean, I don't want to overstress it, of course, but you're offered a fresh start in a sense, at least for this part.
Makes perfect sense, yes.
Galina, what you're saying, moving it obviously in the right direction is very important, because if you have a fresh start and then you have an environment that pushes you to a negative outcome, this is, of course, not beneficial. So it needs to be integrated. And I think it's helpful if you have someone who helps you to integrate it.
Absolutely. And also now that I'm working on initiatives for Ukraine and the other conflict zones, you know, there are clinical trials in Israel happening. That also becomes very important there. How fresh the trauma needs to be, and also what's the environment that people are being reintegrated. Because when they are in this highly susceptible state, re-traumatization then can be more harmful.
Can you really quick for our listeners describe a use case, a case where treatment happens for somebody who goes through war in Ukraine, for instance?
So in Ukraine right now, the legislation is like in the US in the 70s. Unfortunately, there no clinical trials are allowed. And we are working with the Ministry of Health to allow the studies. So what's happening in Ukraine now is ketamine-assisted therapy. And actually, we didn't touch on that, but it is the closest case study to what psychedelics are now trying to achieve, is the ketamine. So Spravato, which is an S version of racemic ketamine. So you can think of ketamine as two molecules that are basically mirrors of each other. And what J&J did is they took the one version of it, separated it from the other, and they packaged it as the new substance. So they received a patented use for it, which is called Spravato, and it is prescribed for treatment-resistant depression. But it also just got a label extension in January 25 for major depressive disorder, which is huge, because before you needed. So only the patients that failed two depression treatments over at least 6 months period were allowed to be prescribed. And right now, also patients that didn't fail any treatment but have a diagnosed major depressive disorder with an acute suicidality, either ideation or behavior, they also are allowed to get it, which is huge from a market perspective, but it's great for the patient perspective, because classical antidepressants take weeks or even sometimes months to work. While ketamine is a quick dissociative medicine, it acts on NMDA receptors, so not the same as classical psychedelics. It's not serotonin, it's acetylcholine system, but it leads to a quick reduction of depressive symptoms. Within hours, you can see the reduction.
Good idea and by Johnson & Johnson. No question.
For those of our listeners who are not in Berlin, don't go to Berghain, which I also don't do, but because they don't let me in because I'm too old. No, but ketamine has been for some time a very popular party drug, and it's an off-patent anesthetic. So for when I worked with mice, we actually used ketamine for anesthesia back in the days. So it's like a bit of a mixed bag, and I think it's also not as clean, I would say, as psychedelics or as classical psychedelics, because it has some addictive potential, I think, ketamine in comparison. So that's also part of the reason why they did this no-spray version, in the hope that it would be maybe, is that true, that it's less addictive? Or the idea was at least that this formulation that they have would be less addictive. But again, I think, I mean, there are always, of course, side effects and risks to drugs. And I think in depression, and this is something that we haven't discussed, why this is actually such a big unmet need, because there is a massive proportion of people who have depression who don't react to the current drugs. And 30%. I think this is, 30%, I somewhere read even 40%. So it's a high number of people who don't have any benefit. And I think having new options, and they are also all from similar classes. So ketamine was the first real innovative thing that happened, I think, in 30 years or something. Yeah. So this is a huge field, and it's really important to bring new things to patients who don't react, because I think if you have acute suicidal ideations, this is really, yeah, I mean, it's a severe problem. And I think actually death by suicide in younger men is one of the highest mortality risks. So it's quite clear that something has to happen and why this innovation is so necessary and why this long break in research that happened was maybe not the best idea.
Absolutely, yeah. And I saw actually new data from the US, and women or girls, teenage girls, are double as likely to have suicidal ideation than men. And it's roughly 1 in 3 teenage girls.
Oh my God, it's terrible.
Yeah. And I don't know about whether nasal spray is less addictive. I'm not sure about that, but I think it was more about making it more, so the efficacy-safety ratio was better. And it's also the way it is administered. Mm-hmm. So you can't just get it at home, but there is it's called REMS, so Risk Evaluation and Mitigation Program. And you can only get it in doctor's office. And there is a 2 hours observation window where you basically sit in a room nearby and they have a camera just to see that you're not sedated or disoriented. And after 2 hours, you can go home. But for example, you're not allowed to drive on the same day. So there are quite some serious safety around it, so that if you take it medically prescribed and properly, you won't get addicted. It's more from the party settings and how people abuse it.
Yeah. Going back to the use case in Ukraine, so there you would then be the use of ketamine there.
Exactly. Yeah, I wanted to come back to Ukraine. And that's basically, there are veterans rehabilitation clinics where I know now it's called the Forest Glades, and they are now doing a pilot study with 25 veterans that are treatment resistant, and they, like, regular antidepressants with psychotherapy don't help them. And so they are going into this rehabilitation program with ketamine. And actually, there is an NGO I'm also working with, which is called Heal Ukraine Trauma. And they have developed a group treatment protocol for ketamine-assisted therapy. Because again, when you think about scaling up and the scale at which the mental health crisis is happening, we don't have enough therapists to have so much preparation and then integration, and also during the experience in sitting with patients one-on-one. So they're doing it in groups, which is actually much better, coming back to our set and setting, and how then the context, you have this support group basically of people that went through similar experience, post-traumatic, but then treatment, and then they can keep integrating and stay in touch over, you know, years to support each other, which I think the group treatment and group integration protocols have a huge potential.
Yeah, and I think this is also one interesting part of it, is that psychedelics, no, not ketamine, but classical psychedelics, they also help with emotions. You have more positive emotions towards other people. And I think for this ruminating disorders, they are very common, that you self-isolate, you have a very negative self-image, which then leads you to isolate further. And I mean, it's shown, of course, that if you are not feeling well and you are interacting with other people, you will feel better. But if you have this negative spiral in your head that keeps you from leaving the house, this cannot happen. So having these more group experience that make you feel better are actually, I would say, a very good idea.
Yeah. And I think we have a crisis of belonging anyway in the world with the social media, people feeling separate.
Apart from Ukraine, of course we do. Yes.
Yeah. So creating the spaces of belonging where people can be together and share their emotions and be vulnerable and talk about the crisis they are going through is healing on its own. And that's why I think in psychedelics for sure, but in general, it's such an artificial separation of drug therapy and psychological support, because especially for mental health, we need both. And we also need healthy sleep, healthy nutrition, and everything around it, the whole environment needs to be appropriate.
We're talking about this all the time in this podcast. The elephant in the room is the subtitle of this show, Psychedelics Renaissance. And I have to admit that a couple years back, I had a group of students and their task was to produce a podcast. And they picked the topic microdosing. That led me to getting back in touch with the whole scenery because I did not have a clue that the era of banning LSD was kind of over and there's research again going on. So 70 years of experience with the drug, then a little bump, and now applications are waiting. And I would like to ask the F question, which is the future question, obviously. What are we going to do with this stuff?
I will answer first and then hand over. I think there is clearly a path for it. I think it's a really challenging model for the pharma and biotech industry because, as Galina said, it works well if it's integrated. And the current model is to give something to people that they can get basically for themselves in the pharmacy and you don't need to care about them afterwards. That's a little bit overstated, but I think it's, we know that we have this massive mental health crisis and we know we don't, I mean, there are so many people not getting a spot at therapy, which is really detrimental. And the hope would be that this is actually also not only as the substance does something good. I personally don't really have a stake in it, but I find it so interesting because I think it has this signal character that it actually opens up a window of hope for people, that you have this idea that it's not only taking antidepressants that then don't work or work for only a time and make you feel numb and miserable, but that you actually have a chance to activate the self-healing that your body, your brain contains. And I think this is something that I would find a very hopeful and interesting prospect. I would say in the future, there is a chance that some of the psychedelics get approval from the regulators and will be used. But I think it will be probably in very fixed settings where you have someone with you who helps you integrate. And there has been a rejection of MDMA just very recently by the FDA, which I think many people didn't quite understand. They were asking for more data, and I think they were being very careful with what the studies showed. I think it looked actually not so bad. So I would say the future will show that psychedelics get a place in psychotherapy. But I think for me, that's not even the most important part. I think the important part is that it will get better treatment and better options to people in general beyond the psychedelic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think there is a very high chance that psychedelics will be approved. It's just a matter of time and which ones, because there is a number of psychedelics now in studies. As Izzy mentioned, it's not necessarily the most, let's say, money-making model, because, you know, it's good to make money in chronic treatments that you need to take forever. But actually the promise, and that's why I worked in psychedelic field, the promise is that they might be disease-modifying treatments. So it might be that you take it once and then you never have the depression again or the addiction, which addiction, again, is a chronic condition right now. The most famous NGO that has been working on it is MAPS, so from Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Scientists, that is led by Rick Doblin. From the 90s, he wrote his PhD thesis on MDMA treatment for PTSD, and he has spent 30 years fundraising from philanthropists, and he actually managed, of course, and the whole association, but Rick Doblin spearheaded it, to get it to two positive phase 3 studies, which showed significant efficacy improvement in PTSD. And, you know, one of the studies showed that 67% of PTSD patients no longer were fit in the diagnosis of PTSD after these 3 sessions of MDMA versus 32% in placebo. So 2/3 of patients with severe PTSD did not have it afterwards, which is incredible when you think about it. But of course, the main criticism there was how the data were collected and the safety data. So there were very loud cases of specific accusations. One was sexual misconduct. And then there was also some reports about biased data gathering and that not all severe adverse effects were recorded, like suicidality was not always recorded. So because of those loud cases, basically it produced so much fear for regulators, which already, you know, it's stigmatized treatment. So we need to be really, the way we collect data needs to be extra perfect when you're working with such stigmatized substances. And unfortunately, it was not. So because of that, it was rejected. That's my take on it. And also, I think coming to science communication, they actually had an advisory board 2 months before the FDA meeting, which already raised all of those concerns. And Lycos, which is now the new for-profit of MAPS, they did not address those concerns that were raised in those 2 months. Well, in those 2 months, I think there was a window of opportunity where they could have gone and spoken of how exactly the data integrity was preserved there. And nobody at FDA, you know, loses a job by not approving a good drug, but you can totally lose a job by approving a non-safe drug. And it's not the end of MDMA. I'm sure they are going to do another trial and they will show it because the data is very strong, but it will just take another couple of years.
And interestingly, it's actually something that a lot of veteran associations are advocating for, because it's the people who have PTSD. Yeah.
I actually want to mention also that there were 3 breakthrough therapy designations that are awarded for different psychedelics right now between stages 3, so in late stage clinical trials, which is a huge sign that FDA boss sees a big potential there and also a big need.
I'm not exactly sure about who's losing their jobs at FDA these days, but that's a very different discussion. I think very, very fascinating stuff. And I think in like a year from now, we have to just repeat this podcast, because I do believe that the landscape will have changed by then a little bit. Thank you. Pleasure meeting you, Galina.
Great meeting you too.
Thank you, Easy, of course.
Thank you. And sorry for talking so much today, but I could have talked for much longer as usual.
Absolutely.
The biochemistry of the mystical psychedelics renaissance, which is not in full bloom, but it's getting there. I think we worked on this during this podcast. Please, if you like the show, give us a like, subscribe to it, look everything up at
sciencetales.com.
sciencetales.com. And I think the liner notes of this show will be a little more in volume.
Yeah, and we'll link a lot of studies for people who are interested to read up, of course.
And what do we plan for next time?
The dark genome.
So please tune in again at the BioRevolution podcast.
Thanks for listening and hope you tune in next time.
And I'll see you in a year.